This episode of Section D with Hugo MacDonald was first broadcast on Tuesday the 2nd of July on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on today's show, we head to Beirut to take the temperature at the Lebanese capital's second design week.
Beirut design week is something that we finally need to have in this city. There's so much design happening, so much creative talent. All over the world you hear about Lebanese designers going around in fashion and products and graphics and doing amazing things.
Following the latest round of men's collections, we get a read on the future of menswear with Monocle's fashion director, Takeharu Sato.
I think it's something to do with this economy. Overall, not only young brands, but also the old brands, they started producing quite a vibrant designs. Lots of colors and, you know, clashes with patterns and candy prints and so on. Like, that made me basically just happy. You know, like, okay, it's not the end of the world.
And as London celebrates graduation of a flood of new architecture students, we drop in on the Bartlett School of Architecture's degree show.
At the Bartlett, architecture is not seen within certain limits. Architecture is a very broad field, and in fact some of the most interesting conversations on architecture happen when one is sort of crossing the boundaries into other fields, when architecture becomes poetry or when architecture becomes film.
Plus, we chat to the directors of the London Architecture Festival and we visit an exhibition of unsung heroes of Norwegian design in Tokyo too. That's all to come over the next hour here on Monocle 24. We begin this week's Section D in Beirut. While Lebanon has been making headlines for violence and sectarian clashes, its capital has been hosting the second annual Beirut Design Week. A chance for the country's design industry to come together and show a different side of an embattled country. It's been heralded as a great success. But how vibrant is the design scene in a country that currently lacks a proper government, let alone a fully functioning infrastructure? Ed Woodhouse talks to people on the ground to find out more.
One of the most common questions expats living in Beirut get asked is, do all the women there wear burqas? It's a question that will provoke a grin from most of those to whom it's put, because the truth is just about the exact opposite. Beirutis take the notion that life is a catwalk to a whole new level. Their devotion to style and fashion puts Paris to shame. And their eye for design is in evidence everywhere you look, from the city's chicly appointed bars to its many dizzyingly expensive furniture shops. It's clear that these are a people for whom style is central. But what of the local design culture? Is all this imported taste, or are there people on the ground setting the design agenda for the city? The fact that the city's second annual Beirut Design Week has seen people flying in from all over the world to take part hints at the answer. Design Week's co-founder, Doreen Tutikan, explains why they felt Beiruti design needed celebrating.
Well, we were just thinking that Beirut Design Week is something that we finally need to have in this city. There's so much design happening, so much creative talent. All over the world you hear about Lebanese designers going around in fashion and products and graphics and doing amazing things. And there really wasn't a platform to really showcase that in the country. So we thought, you know, 2012 was the first time to do it. And now 2013 is the second one and it's getting bigger and better.
Asking if the Lebanese government is involved prompts gales of laughter. It seems that the design industry is pretty overlooked by the powers that be in Lebanon.
I guess there still isn't really the awareness about what design is. I mean, you know, these sort of, you got this idea of these dinosaurs being in ministries and not really knowing about what's going on. And there's just, maybe it goes as far as classical art for them. So I think if we, year after year, start to educate, you know, everybody around, I think soon enough they will also be interested because they will see how beneficial this is to the country's economy. I mean, I've heard so many people just coming from abroad just for Beirut Design Week. I mean, they just should hear about this, right?
The idea that there is an industry generating both money and good news stories for Lebanon, whilst being wholly unappreciated by an obstructive government, is a theme that comes up in almost every conversation you have about Lebanese design.
I mean, this is our story. People in Lebanon, individuals try to do something with their lives, and basically the government doesn't help them. This is the story. We're always trying to do our best, and our politicians are trying to do their worst. Basically, if you want to summarize it, this is it.
Jewelry designer Nada Zeina took a break from the buzzing rooftop launch party for her latest collection of exquisitely handcrafted gold jewelry to explain why there is such a disproportionate number of successful designers here, despite the fact that it's a small city which often lives under such trying circumstances.
I think that Lebanese people have learned that they can only count on themselves. They cannot expect anything from anybody. So basically, you cannot really be a just employee, because you will not go very far. And so you can design. There are exposed to so many civilizations because of the war, they had to travel a lot. So they've seen a lot, and they've heard of it. I mean, they really have been exposed to many things. So it's normal that they will try to do something on their own. And this is why you have that many people doing nice things. We're confronted to ugly things, to what I call in French obscurantism. It's like darkness, it's the dark side of a human being. So this is very hard, because this is our resistance. It's a daily resistance to keep on doing something interesting, to not let go to hatred and bad feelings. We have no other solution but to try harder. But sometimes, believe me, sometimes I just feel like, oh my God, that's it, I stop. But I don't stop. This is the proof, you see, today. I have a lot of people, I have a new collection, a lot of people are coming. We really live day by day.
It's a compelling idea that Beirut is so drawn to beauty and has such a vibrant design industry because it counterbalances the ugliness so often present in the country's politics and sectarian divides. But most importantly, Nada's work is bought all over the world, and like the majority of successful Beiruti designers, it's this that gives her success. The vitality that the Beirut design industry enjoys comes from the recognition it has won outside the country. But what about those aforementioned glamorous domestic buyers? Are they supporting the industry? And if not, what does this mean for the future of Lebanese design? Ghassan Salameh is a product designer who focuses on furniture and lighting. His Design Week exhibition included a staggeringly inventive mechanical inset-like standing lamp, and it has seen him recognized as one of the great talents uncovered by the event. So what does someone up-and-coming think of the Beirut design industry?
In terms of product design and furniture design, most of the Lebanese people, they just like the rich people who actually can pay to get their furniture, they import their furniture from famous designers abroad. Few of them they get from the Lebanese designers, but then again there are a handful of designers, you know, you can count them. They are very known, and at some point it becomes a little bit limited because you don't really have a lot of choices. I mean, you have a lot of Lebanese designers, architects who are extremely successful abroad. When I was in Europe, I toured a lot of cities, I went to a lot of museums, and I started discovering Lebanese artists being exposed in museums in Europe, in major museums in Europe that I haven't even heard of in Lebanon. You know, and you can tell like how much Lebanese people can be successful abroad, but they cannot be here. And then you come here and you see that your government kind of works against you by bringing foreign architects or foreign designers to contract major projects, when you have the actual talent here and you have the possibility to work with people here.
The night before Design Week started, the country was again pushed closer to all-out sectarian violence, with the army battling followers of a hardline Sunni cleric. The interviews in this piece were conducted at glamorous parties, while a few dozen kilometres away, there was open warfare on the streets of Lebanon's third city, Sidon. Lebanon's design industry is built on dichotomies just like this. It is successful globally, despite being for the large part overlooked at home. Design Week was such a huge hit that it's given the industry its proudest moment so far, yet at the same time, the host nation is wandering back into chaos. And this is the great irony of the Lebanese design industry. It contains a huge amount of talented and successful people who are constantly striving to perfect form while the country around it fails to function. For Monocle, in Beirut, this is Ed Woodhouse.
You're listening to Section D. Lots more coming up, including a chat with the future stars of London's architecture scene at the Bartlett, and a look into the future of menswear with our very own fashion director too.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
For many, the process of cooking is as pleasurable as the meal itself. Cue the school bell. From a Tasmanian cook who guides his guest from garden to kitchen, to a chef-led market journey in Israel, Monocle Films have hand-selected some cookery schools who focus their flavors on learning.
A wide variety of courses are available. There are two-day butchery courses, a charcuterie special session, and even one focusing on tomatoes and all the ways to use them.
Eat, cook, learn. On film, on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D. Now, summer in London is marked by numerous additions to the design world. Alongside high-profile public openings such as the Serpentine Pavilion, there are many less publicised but no less significant shows on offer too. In particular, the British capital contains a wealth of burgeoning architectural talent, with some of the world's top architecture schools brimming with the building designers and city planners of tomorrow. For a brief window every summer, they open their doors to the public to showcase the students' final degree projects. In the first of a three-part series on some of the best degree exhibitions, Annabelle Bly brings us this report from the opening of the Bartlett School of Architecture Summer Show.
The Bartlett School of Architecture's Summer Show is one of the world's largest of its kind. This year, over 500 students present an incredible range of creative and visual work, from models and drawings to life-size fragments, to films, multimedia installations, and computer fabrications. World famous, the Bartlett regularly ranks as Britain's top architecture school, and the summer show attracts a commensurate amount of interest from not just academic peers, but architecture firms, designers, and Joe Public, who come to see the diverse creativity that's on display. To hear more about the exhibition, I spoke with the school's director, Marcos Cruz.
At the Bartlett, architecture is not seen within certain limits. Architecture is a very broad field, and in fact, some of the most interesting conversations on architecture happen when one is sort of crossing the boundaries into other fields, when architecture becomes poetry, or when architecture becomes film, or when architecture becomes pure engineering, or crosses the field into the medical sciences, then it's when architecture becomes really challenging and interesting. And we in the School of Architecture believe that in nowadays you do not only prepare architects to sit in front of a computer in an architecture office. The many different types and forms and ways of practice of architecture. And many of our students indeed do become, I would say, cultural agents rather than necessarily in a strict manner of understanding what an architect is. Having said that, the majority of them do go into offices, into practice, and become also leading figures in the field.
So for you, Marcos, what are some of the highlights of this year's show?
I think there's an increasing preoccupation of Bartlett students with our current reality. And I think this year's summer show highlights that in many parts and many units. The field trips are very carefully chosen. The majority of cities and landscapes are very troublesome or highly contested areas in the world, from places like Iceland and the melting of ice and the problems of climate change, to Middle Eastern cities, to the extraordinary sort of boom and sprawl, urban sprawl of Hong Kong and the River Delta. And that means that a lot of these projects are underpinned through work that is very carefully observational of these cultural, political, social, and environmental problems that these places have. And I think this show, more than ever before, gives a response to that. Housing is becoming increasingly a topic. There were years where at the Bartlett housing was almost a taboo. Almost only public buildings. Right now, you have more and more housing schemes because housing is by far the biggest programmatic challenge for our future in architecture. there are more and more people on Earth living, there's more and more housing being built everywhere, but the housing schemes and the housing discussion is very out of date. It's very old-fashioned in a funny way. If in the 60s and 70s there was a big focus on housing and there were great responses given at that time as a response to the crisis of the modern movement, and nowadays there is hardly any response. So the fact that the Bartlett is picking up on that is sort of showing that there's an increased interest in one of these real issues.
When you see the show itself, it's a huge feat of engineering and there are so many works on display. What is the audience that you are trying to attract to come and see the show?
We get obviously a lot of students from other schools who are coming to look at what's happening at the Bartlett. An enormous amount of new students who might be coming students at the Bartlett, who are prospective students, often now traveling from across the Atlantic and from Asia. We do get a lot of practitioners who are coming to see what is new, what new thoughts they are, which students they would like to employ. Many directors of companies who are coming exactly for that purpose, to choose their new staff. But we also get increasingly more an audience of people who are outside the architecture field. It means people from the arts are coming, or in the graphic designs, because the Bartlett Summer Show is becoming such a big event that it's known that it's sort of inspiring for any person who's coming. But the fact that it was part of the London Architecture Festival this year meant it was part of a bigger event. So it's not only an architecture school having a bit of work being exhibited, it's actually part of a London scene now that uses these exhibitions to promote its extraordinary diverse output in terms of architecture.
The Bartlett might receive some criticism from elsewhere that it's so artistic and that it's so focused on pushing boundaries that it's not based in reality, perhaps.
I think the artistic drive is to do with talent. I think we do believe in talent. And we believe that every single student has his or her own talent. The important thing is that the students need to discover their talents and their strength. And once they are the masters of the medium they use, and they do know themselves, and they start thriving through their talents, they become the artists of their own work. We do give a lot of importance to the way in which they communicate their work, both orally and through their portfolios, the drawings and the films and models, which means that the students do spend a lot of time being very carefully in crafting their models and drawing in a manner in which the communication of these drawings is on a higher level. There's no doubt about it. It's a bit like a poet who doesn't know the vocabulary, has great ideas but can't communicate it and can't write the right poetry. It doesn't work. You need to be a master of your own medium and your own ways of communication. Real issues are almost everywhere now, and they're the main concern of every single student in the Bartlett. Interesting, there are very few real utopias. There were years where that was very common practice, but I think we shifted from the 90s, where ideas were the main driver, the conceptual ideas, into a period where we are now much more into the applied knowledge period. Students are applying their knowledge and their observations on real issues, even though by crossing the boundaries they're often speculating with scenarios in order to be critical about them. But it's all about reality. It's all about what is happening in our world. There are no inventions of scenarios really happening anymore.
Annabelle Bly at the Bartlett School of Architecture degree show there. You're listening to Section D. Now, when it comes to design, you might think first of Scandinavia. And when you think of Scandinavia, you might be thinking about Finland, Denmark and Sweden. What's missing in this Scandinavian design jigsaw puzzle, though, is Norway. And all that's about to change. This is thanks to Fuglen. Fuglen originally opened in 1963 as a tea and coffee shop in Oslo. But it recently developed an initiative to resurrect Norway's forgotten design heritage too. Following their first successful exhibition held in January in Oslo, Fuglen, which means bird in Norwegian, flew the same exhibition to Tokyo. Our very own Jun Toyofuku from our Tokyo bureau spoke to Fuglen's design expert, Pepe Trulsen, to find out more.
What we're showing is a wide selection of Norwegian design objects, mainly from the period 1940 to 1975. The main thought behind this exhibition is to kind of visualize what Norway had to contribute with in this time or period.
How many pieces of furniture and artworks do you have?
It's a total of 348 pieces divided on furniture, ceramic, glass, metalworks, porcelain, figurines, art pieces.
Maybe you can point us some of your favorite or not to be missed pieces.
Yeah, right now we're standing in a room we have created, which kind of visualize a middle class home from this period, and we're standing in front of dining group containing of dining table, six chairs and a sideboard, everything made out of beautiful rosewood and leather, designed by Torbjørn Oftdal in 1963. It kind of represent the typical furniture home of the middle classes from this age.
Presumably you have quite a great collection and selection of Norwegian vintage design from 40s, 50s and 60s. And I wonder if what's your future plan? Obviously this Norwegian Icons exhibition is going to New York this November. But it sounds like you can open your little sort of Fugle Museum. is there any future plan?
Not really, because we want these objects to spread out to people who appreciate it. It will make me more happy if people bought them based on some kind of experience through feelings or interest or being a collector, being enjoyed in their own homes, than keeping it all by yourself in a museum. Basically, this project, Norwegian Icons exhibition, is something we're going to do for at least 3 years. We're finishing up this year in New York in November, and then we start a new round next year. Now, what we have been presenting in Oslo and in Tokyo is just a small part of what we can dive into, because as we are in this working process, we start to discover more and more. So there's so much to communicate, and we already have outstanding invitations to put up this exhibition in London, in Paris, in Moscow, and even Vladivostok. So it seems like there's a big interest in what we are trying to communicate. And I also believe it's the right timing, because basically it's collectors or people that are special interested in vintage design that buy it. And you know, it's been a lot of focus on Scandinavian design the last years, and when it comes to Sweden and Denmark and Finland, it's not so much more to discover. It's more, you know, most of it is already out in the light. Many of the objects are new produced. So I think those people who have this special interest in vintage design there and being collectors, they are like in the need for something new to discover. And that's what I believe we are doing now. It's like almost opening a box of candy. Suddenly you have the possibility to start to dive into many new names, many new objects. Suddenly you can satisfy your hunger for the search, expand your knowledge. What we are doing also with this exhibition, Norwegian Icons, is actually to put Norway back to the map, showing that Norway also have a design history, which is kind of forgotten. It's a big black gap between the 50s and 60s and towards what's going on in Norway at this present time. I believe that this will also give the new designers the confidence that they're lacking, because history is very important in this matter, you know, when it comes to design, to have this history as a support, giving you the credibility as a design nation.
It's quite meaningful to have this Norwegian Icons in Tokyo, just on the other side of Denmark embassy.
Yeah, it feels really good just to show it. And actually, you know, This whole project was initiated by a big sales exhibition that was in London 2 years ago by Philip DePuri. One day we got this catalog in the mail to Fulen, and the catalog, it was saying, you know, important Nordic design. And the cover of this book was the Swedish, Finnish, and Danish flag. So that kind of gave us the statement we needed. You know, now we need to do something about this. You know, we need to show the world, show people in Norway that, you know, we were also part of this.
And that was Pepe Trulsen of Fuglen talking to Arjun Toyofuku there in Tokyo. And in honour of Norway is one of my favourite songs by Norwegian group Røyksopp. This is The Girl and the Robot by Røyksopp featuring Robin. That was The Girl and the Robot by Røyksopp featuring Robin. Still to come in part two of Section D, we'll sit down with Vicky Richardson, Head of Architecture, Design and Fashion at the British Council, and Sarah Ichioka, Director of the Architecture Foundation too. Before that though, it's time to talk men's fashion. Well, I'm joined now by Monocle's fashion director, Takaharu Sato. Thank you very much for coming in, Taka.
Hello.
So you started your journey in Pitti and then moved to Milan and then to Paris.
Yes.
And I'm interested, what is the mood in the fashion industry at the moment?
Well, apparently it is very like a difficult time for the economy, but I felt quite a positive energy. I keep actually saying that since the last few seasons, especially after 2008, it's an interesting moment. You know, some brands have to maybe close down. Some brands are growing, interestingly, when they do quite consistent designs and philosophy, and especially they have a quite strong sort of, you know, iconic items and so on. Like, they keep selling out.
It's interesting. I mean, I'm going to stop you there just to say it's probably not too dissimilar from what's happening in the furniture industry, that the brands that have a very strong identity, particularly the brands that do one thing very well, are the ones that are doing amazingly well.
For example, one of the successful brands in Italy is Stone Island. And of course, Italy is the place for crisis for the moment, but their sales in 2012 increased 30% against 2011.
No way.
Because they have quite such an iconic pieces, you know, like Stone Island and jackets with goggles. And they have been running the label since 30 years. And the customers who you know, started consuming the brands since they are young, they became father and they started having children, sons. And they take those kids to the shops and they buy more.
Yeah.
So it's a good kind of like circulation for sales. And I thought that was quite interesting when I was having a chat with Sabina Ribetti, the owner of the brand.
So it's not all bad news that we would sometimes be led to believe from reading the business pages of newspapers for the fashion industry. Mm-hmm. You mentioned also young brands, that there are new brands that are doing quite well as well.
And I think it's something to do with this economy. Like overall, not only young brands, but also the old brands, they started producing quite a vibrant designs, especially like a men's fashion for spring, summer. Lots of colors and, you know, crashes with patterns and candy prints and so on. Like, that made me basically just happy. You know, like, okay, it's not the end of the world. You know?
Exactly.
We have to live our life.
We can't just live in grays and
browns
and blacks.
Yeah. And then one of the interesting brands I discovered, or we discovered, was the brand from Turkey, Istanbul, called Rumisu, R-U-M-I-S-U. They are showing actually like the first time in Pitti. And 2-year-old label run by those two sisters from Istanbul. And they work with the associations such as SIDA, Swedish International Development Association.
Exactly.
Correct?
Yeah.
As well as the UNDP, United Nations Development Programme, to help the minority people in the southeast of Turkey. Basically, there are loads of unemployed women in the area, like especially like Kurdish people, but they have amazing hand skills for silk and textiles. And And they discover those people and go, oh, let's help them and give them a job, and not with them, you know, a minimum wage, but they give them like a good
paying
wage.
Yeah, pay.
Yes, exactly. Then, you know, Turkey is well known for its textile and silk, and they produce beautiful products. And then, of course, not only just doing a traditional methods, but also because the label is run by those young sisters. So like they make like quite a, like a dinosaur print, like cartoonish, like it's quite kind of like it makes me feel like I'm watching kind of like fairy tale, you know. Kind
sounds
of thing.
Charming.
Like it's really nice, like really charming label. So,
and this is mainly shirts or
like
or?
They make scarves, mm, and they make some dolls as well, little dolls, and they could be, it's quite playful, so like they could be enjoyed by not only kids but also adults. And it's really nice. Like it's, yeah, I would love to keep an eye on the label.
Very nice. And also this is interesting from Turkey, which is traditionally a factory nation where, yes, a lot of people would have gone to have their textiles produced cheaply, mm-hmm, but actually emerging as a company with design, a country with design credentials,
yeah,
in its,
sure,
own right.
Sure,
as well.
Exactly. I also went to, but that was last year, I went to a couple of big factories, and you recognize like famous labels, like everybody knows these names like internationally, and they produce those products for the brands, and I was just
yeah, the skill is there,
yeah,
they just,
yeah,
need the confidence, maybe
fascinated
to,
by the, mm, skills and quality, and, yeah, and also like there are some young talents from Turkey, like they studied in London or New York, and they brought the inspirations back to their, you know, own country, and having a collaboration with those factories and making something interesting with good quality. So like I think, yeah, this, that's the place to keep an eye on also.
And I mean, fashion season, the collections, of the shows themselves are such a spectacle.
Yes.
If there was one show that you've seen that sticks in your mind and will always remind you of this season in particular,
I'd love to mention Bottega Veneta. Especially this collection was very strong. I really liked the first slot that was consisted of kind of jersey material, like well-tailored pieces, like grey pieces. Basically the jackets, and then the lapels are a little bit kind of cut off, but like a nice shape and kind of tight-ish shape. But it's actually like, because of the material, they looked really, really comfortable. So like sharp, you know, tailoredness meets like comfort. And like, I think it
sounds
really
a bit
cool,
more wearable maybe than a dinosaur print from Turkey.
I think so. For men, yes.
Lovely. Well, Tucker Harrod Sotto, thank you very much indeed for sharing your thoughts and your highlights from this season's spring-summer men's collections. You're listening to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, on Monocle 24. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture, and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the time shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
This is Section D on Monocle 24. Welcome back. Now, the London Festival of Architecture ran for the month of June across the capital. From students to global megastars, London is home to arguably the greatest concentration of architects in the world. And the festival is a platform for exploring their work, as well as providing an opportunity for discourse of a more international flavour in the industry too. We dispatched our reporters to speak to two of the festival's initiating partners to find out what the festival means for London. Is it merely a showcase, or does it have any lasting impact on the direction of the city's industry? First up, Fernando Augusto Pacheco dropped in on Director of the Architecture Foundation, Sarah Ichioka.
How would you compare the first festival in 2004 to the one this year? They started at completely different scales, I suppose. In 2004, the festival, which started as the Clerkenwell Architecture Biennale, I believe, was set up as a counterpoint to the Venice Architecture Biennale, and the founding director, Peter Murray, saw it as a very localized festival, so one that was about London's amazing wealth of kind of native architectural talent and practice, and also about London's built environment. So rather than an international program that's helicoptered in without any lasting legacy, and it being very much about the economy of London and the environment of London itself, I think we've maintained a certain amount of that spirit in that the festival is very much about celebrating all of the amazing richness of London's architectural culture. We're really excited this year that we have a number of core invited institutional partners who kind of represent the creme de la creme of kind of the cultural world in London. So from the Serpentine Gallery through to people like the Barbican Centre, working alongside the four key initiating partners. In addition, the majority of the really amazing schools of architecture, which of course is one of this city's incredible asset.
Do you see any particular trends this year?
Perhaps it can see a lot of our partner institutions actively reaching out outside of their four walls to engage with the urban fabric of the city around them and using architecture and design to do that. So for example, the Leandro Ehrlich installation that Barbican have commissioned in Dalston, which is kind of questioning, it's such a transitional part of London, and it's really bringing to light some of the Victorian heritage of the area as a way of kind of, I think, probing a little bit the changes that are happening. That's a really good example of an institution going off-site and commissioning, in this case, an artist who works at an architectural scale to question urban change. I think equally South Bank Centre's Festival of Neighbourhood has been doing that in a really interesting way, animating the public spaces that surround South Bank Centre.
You've also mentioned that the festival changed. Why did it change?
I think the festival has always aimed to be very inclusive, and it had built over its kind of 8-year lifespan to date, it had slowly built a very strong network of like-minded institutions, and we thought it was a good time to maybe more actively formalize that relationship and acknowledge the amazing contribution that these partner institutions have made, and also to understand that, speaking totally frankly, we're all operating as cultural institutions and educational institutions in an environment of limited resources, and working on a networked model we thought was a fantastic way of pooling those resources and gaining strength in numbers.
And finally, I just want to ask, how does the Fringe fit into the festival highlights?
One of the things I love about London is how many people are kind of keen to mount activities and let people know about what they're doing. And there's always been a really active group that kind of, as long as the festival's been around, of practices or individuals who are keen to put on open studios, put on walks, talks, open up their homes, etc. And the Fringe, in a way, which is being coordinated in partnership with the London Architecture Diary as media partner, is a really nice way of, I mean, there's always been a Fringe, I suppose, but it was just nice to give a name to it and give a bit of a shape to it. And we were very inspired by Edinburgh International Festival, where there's kind of the core institutional program and then Fringe, which is strengthened by its kind of all the projects accumulated networking together. So again, there's a kind of central institutional network, and then there's the more distributed Fringe network.
That was the director of the Architecture Foundation, Sarah Ichioka, talking to our Fernando Augusto Pacheco there. Meanwhile, across the city, our reporter Lillian Hess spoke to Director of Architecture, Design and Fashion at the British Council, Vicky Richardson.
The Festival of Architecture has been taking place all throughout London during June, and we've organised it with 25 different organisations in the capital, and I think it's a real mixture actually of British architecture and architecture and indeed art and design from around the world, and I think that reflects London itself really as a place that people come to study from around the world and have stayed, set up studios and I think there's a very thriving international community here in London, and that really makes the festival what it is and gives it its kind of richness and diversity.
What do you think are some of the highlights? What would people like to see?
I just mentioned something that we at the British Council have organised. We're one of the partners of the London Festival of Architecture, and our contribution is specifically on the international side. So every year we work with London's embassies and the National Institutes of Culture, and we ask them to contribute an idea, a project or an exhibition to the festival. This year we asked them to contribute an architectural model of a project from their country that's either under construction or about to be under construction, because we wanted to create an exhibition that's sort of like a snapshot of what the world's going to look like very soon. So it's called Atlas of the Unbuilt World. Mm-hmm. And we produced a large format publication to go with it based on the sort of design of 1950s atlases. And it's been a really amazing exhibition. We had more than 60 models from 39 countries made of a huge variety of different materials using different techniques, some using 3D printing techniques, some extremely basic corrugated cardboard. And it was really fantastic, actually, to be able to have all of those different models in one room representing a whole range of projects. And we had more than half of the architects came over for that as well. So there was lots of opportunity for sort of networking and discussion about architecture and specifically about model making as well.
What does one hope what people take away from the festival? Is it just a nice London fair, or is it also about finding solutions to make the industry better?
I wouldn't say it's so much just about the industry. I think what the festival does is show how important architecture is to London. I mean, it's been really phenomenal, the range of different organisations who have put on events, exhibitions, installations during the festival. And I think that shows that architecture is, really one of London's greatest things and is fundamentally important, not just to architects and to schools of architecture and the profession, but to our main cultural organisations. If you look at the Barbican Centre, they've got a really wonderful installation in Dalston by an Argentine artist, Leandro Ehrlich, which is based on looking at the typical Victorian terraced house of London, but sort of subverting it. Obviously, there's the Serpentine Pavilion by the Japanese architect Sofa Jimoto. The Serpentine Pavilion has become such an important feature of London life. It happens in June. It's one of the highlights of the festival. So I think, the festival's a time to just put the spotlight on architecture and just to say, look, architecture is one of the main reasons why visitors come to London. About 50% of tourists come to London either for the heritage, architecture or museums and galleries. Obviously, it's a hugely important industry in London as well, if you think of the number of and range of practices here, from really thriving young practices doing interesting sort of experimental work through to the massive international firms who are building all around the world. London is just a real hub for architecture.
How is the state of the architecture industry in London? I mean, the city skyline has changed with the Shard, with the cheese grater by Richard Rogers. Is that good news for the British architects?
I think it's really good news. I think we need more international architects practicing in London and the UK. And it's a shame that, in a way, our planning system, our system of procurement and commissioning of buildings is not more open, because I think if it was, we would have even more and better buildings by overseas architects. But I think one of the problems at the moment is there's a huge contrast between the sense of dynamism that you get in the City of London with these new projects going up, and then the sort of sluggish nature of development in the other parts of the outskirts of London. And obviously beyond the capital, there's a huge contrast to the sorts of things that are being built. And I think we need more of what's going on in the City of London, more of a sense of experimentation, ambition, and, an urge for development, which unfortunately I just think we don't have, which is partly down to the economy and the fact that investment's not being made in development. But I think it's also a culture where we're opposed to big scale development and quite sceptical and suspicious of large scale projects.
Given that all the design schools have just had their graduation shows, like the Bartlett, for example, do you think it's a good time to be a young architect in Britain?
Yes, actually, I do. I mean, apart from the official pathway into the profession, trying to find clients, working for a big firm, or even setting up on your own, I think there's a real spirit of questioning the role of the architect at the moment. And that's actually come from the younger generation, many of whom are saying, well, why should we wait to be commissioned to build something? Let's be more entrepreneurial about this and think of new ways that we can work as architects. And we've seen people like Assemble and Practice Architecture and Aberrant Architecture and really interesting younger firms like that who have really questioned the role of the architect and taken it in a new direction. And I think that's really inspiring to see for the younger crowd.
That was Vicky Richardson, Director of Architecture, Design and Fashion at the British Council, talking to our Lillian Hess there. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Next week we'll be down in Seville to see how Jürgen Meyer Haar's beautiful metropole parasol has changed the notion of public space in the city. We'll be speaking to James Seller, developer behind the London Bridge Quarter and The Shard. And we'll also attend a bizarrely brilliant poetry reading in a store filled with useful stuff in New York, too. Today's show was produced by Alid John and edited by Lolita Laguna and Holly Fisher. You can contact Alid at awj@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on Section D. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out in celebration of the recently graduated clutch of architects in London, here's Pink Floyd with Another Brick in the Wall.